LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
A Supreme Court packing update, Lori Lightfoot leads the way on racial healing, and an ATF exposition on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
If we were in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I am your host, Scott Cosenza, and we've got a packed show with updates from the Supreme Court packing process by the Democrats, a enlightened look at Lori Lightfoot and the mayor of Chicago's attempts to elevate our national discourse on diversity. Sean King, Talcum X, might be in trouble with the law. And it's a big week with gun regulation and the ATF. Let's go ahead and start right on that. Multiple fronts on ATF and the war on guns news this week. First up is a significant rule change at the agency. For many federal agencies, they are allowed to implement their own changes to federal law. We don't call it federal law changes. It's from the Code of Federal Regulations. And what happens is Congress often passes laws that give federal agencies wide latitude to like achieve some goal, like reduce some in a non-gun context. They could identify a certain pollutant in water, for instance, water runoff from industrial facilities, and say, we want less chlorine in the water, or less whatever in the water. And essentially, it's up to the federal agency to make that happen. And one of the ways they can and do make that happen is, for instance, say, okay, you can't put X runoff in the water. Well, if you're a manufacturing facility that depends on the ability to produce that waste as a function of your productive capacity, you might understandably think, gee, that's not something an executive agency director has the right to do. That should be debated in Congress, and a law should be passed, especially when it affects people's livelihood and their very lives. Well, it's an issue that animates conservatives and libertarians, and we think that it's blatantly unconstitutional. Basically, it violates a non-delegation doctrine, which is to say that Congress has not only the authority, but the duty to pass all federal laws. And if they delegate their lawmaking authority to federal agencies, it's an impermissible violation of the separation of powers. You can't give the executive the power of lawmaking. Well, that's what I think that is going on here. In any case, the ATF has the ability within the constructs of the laws that it operates under to change many rules, which result in criminal law violations for Americans, firearms dealers, and manufacturers. What they did this week, and we have the full read in full of the rules on the sponsor of today's program, LibertyNation.com, where if you are desperate for sleep, you can go ahead and read the ATF rules or start on them. I don't believe you'll get very far before you do pass out. They're hard to get through, but there's two things that they offer this series of rule changes that are important for our purposes. Number one, they change the definition of a firearms receiver. Here's why that's important. If we analogize with respect to cars, if you don't happen to know firearms intimately, just like a car, a firearm has lots of different parts, but there's one part that makes the firearm a firearm in the eyes of the law, and it is the sort of registered part or the most important part, legally speaking. If you think about a car, like if you sold the tires off a car, you didn't sell somebody a car, right? Well, what makes it that you sold somebody a car? Well, The car has a title and a VIN. So when you transfer that title or VIN to somebody, that's the transferring of the car. But if that didn't exist, you might say the frame of the car is the one piece that you can't swap out or you can't operate the car without it. And you can say that for the engine too, but bear with me here. You have to have one part that's registered with the government and defined by law as the thing for regulation. They settle on that. And just like with a car, in the example, it's the receiver of the gun that is that registered or part that is delineated as the firearm for legal purposes. So in places where you can't transfer a firearm from one person to another, for instance, without a background check, you can transfer all the parts except for the receiver. So you could give them, if we're talking about a car, you could give them the tires and the seats and the doors and the upholstery, but you couldn't, and the engine, but you can't give them the frame. And that's how it is with firearms. Well, the rule changes that there can be multiple parts of a gun now that are classified as a receiver. To say that this confuses things and introduces chaos into the marketplace of firearms is a massive understatement. And it's coupled with an increase in discretion for the ATF director to make these rule changes. So it would be one thing if they were going to fight about in Congress what constituted this or that, and people had, you know, the ability through their representation to make an effort to change the law or force a change not to be made. But that's not what we have here. What we have is the permission for the FDA director, or the ATF director to make these changes. Well, that is unacceptable for all of us who think that the process of firearm regulation is so important that it needs to be done by the political actors themselves and not their delegates, and certainly not through delegation to the executive for rulemaking or lawmaking authority. Well, okay, that's the first part. Well, here's where it gets worse. What about who that person might be? We have David Chipman is the Biden-Harris nominee to run the ATF, to be the person who makes these calls about whether firearm regulation is going to be more or less expansive. And the problem with Mr. Chipman, in addition to his standing over the bodies of the dead at Waco with a kind of trophy shot that he has taken, and lying about or misrepresenting whether or not the Davidians shot down helicopters. Just as an aside, anybody in the gun rights movement, the Randy Weaver, Ruby Ridge killings or murders, and those at Waco are two incidents that anybody who is remotely associated with, that they want to be treated by those of us, and I totally count myself within the context of the movement, the supporters of gun rights, if they want to be taken as a serious person who isn't motivated as a sort of blood oath against our rights, if they talk about Ruby Ridge or Waco or had an involvement with them, the only acceptable kind of response for people like us is to identify how much of a massive failure it was and how violative it was of the people's rights, of the American citizens' rights involved, as the courts have largely determined. With Ruby Ridge anyway, I think 100% determined. So the fact that he had involvement and has this photo of him, it already leads those of us that are concerned about gun rights to think, this is probably not somebody we can count on to robustly uphold our rights and make sure that this federal agency doesn't trample on them, which they have a significant history of doing. So he gets called up for his confirmation hearing. And another thing about Mr. Chipman is that he spent, I think, 25 years at ATF, and then he went to Everytown for gun safety or Gabby Gifford something or Sarah Brady, gun grabber policy groups. He's a person who is animated against the private ownership of firearms. He doesn't want us to be able, American citizens, to keep and bear arms, and that he would be in charge of making sure that the regulation of firearms in this country is on the up and up and legal, and our rights are defended, including the rights of those in commerce to sell us weapons and ammo, because without that, the right itself is worthless. What are we to think? Somebody who writes op-eds about we need to ban guns and then put them in charge of the agency regulating those firearms that has a massive amount of latitude and discretion seems like a poor choice, except if you are, of course, somebody who thinks that we should have a full assault on the right to keep and bear arms and not stop at the legislature or the courts, but go ahead and use the executive through their discretion to restrict those rights by the people. That's what those of us who are in the, who care about gun rights think about Mr. David Shipman. He has written numerous times about banning AR or banning assault weapons. That is a constant refrain from the gun grabbers. Those of us who kind of know firearms are weary of these pushes for a number of reasons. I'll tell you what my principal reason for objecting to them is, in addition to that, the fact that I believe that it's violative of the Second Amendment, is that a lot of these mass shooters choose AR-15s because they're fairly well suited to the task and because it's the most popular weapons platform in the country. And if you ban the AR-15, does that mean that these people won't shoot someone else or won't use another gun, rather, to accomplish their goals? If the Honda Accord is used in most fatal DUIs or the Camry because they're the most popular cars in America, will banning them then result in a fewer incidents of fatalities on the road? I can't understand how there's a difference in that distinction. It seems to me plainly obvious. And then you have the nefarious kicker on the end, which is that what will happen if people are promised, hey, we have to do something about these shootings, standing on the bodies of the dead children of whatever latest massacre there is, and then putting up the banning of the AR-15 or banning assault weapons as a solution to that? And what happens when the numbers don't come down? What happens when the people, A, still get AR-15s because they're not actually banned in a meaningful way? They're just restricted from people who don't have a lot of money to spend on one or are willing to steal one. And that they choose other firearms to accomplish mass casualty events. Where is the public going to go? Well, it seems to me that they're going to say, well, we just need to ban more and more because this ban didn't work. They're not going to eschew bans and say, well, clearly we need to control people and not guns because that's where the problem is. So it's going to lead to more bans is sort of the idea. Well, Shipman goes before Congress and they want to know from him, what is an assault weapon? You're writing about it. You think it should be banned. What is it, Mr. Shipman? Here's Tom Cotton from Arkansas.
You have called for an assault weapons ban. I have a simple question for you. What is an assault weapon?
Senator, an assault weapon would be, in the context of the question you asked, what Congress defines it as.
So even though he's asked for his definition of what an assault weapons ban is, he refuses to give it. He says, in the context of the question, it's the legislation thing. Well, no, the context of the question is, plainly, what is your definition? He won't do it. Here's another distinction. For those of you who think that don't have weapons, aren't interested in firearms or in the culture of firearms, when you go to a gun store, there is no assault weapons ban section of the gun store. There are shotguns, there are rifles, there are handguns, there's semi-automatics and revolvers and handguns and different ways that we delineate and talk about rifles. But there is no assault weapons category. And I think it was instrumental or illustrative when Senator Cotton asks Mr. Shipman about that.
If I wanted to buy an assault weapon and I walked into Walmart or Cabela's or some other firearm dealers and I looked up on the wall where they were labeling their weapons, would there be a label on the wall for assault weapon?
I don't believe, Senator, and thank you for this question, that the firearms industry has used the term assault rifle in their marketing since there was a ban on it. It was after that that they changed their use of the term assault rifle to the modern sporting rifle.
Well, so I've been in Walmarts and I've been in Cabela's, and I've seen that you can find sections for pistols or handguns or for shotguns or for rifles because those are actual kinds of firearms. I think our exchange here illustrates that there really is no such thing as an assault weapon. That is a term that was manufactured by liberal lawyers and pollsters in Washington to try to scare the American people into believing that the government should confiscate weapons that are wildly popular for millions of Americans to defend themselves and their families and their homes.
How are we going to find out what these weapons are that Mr. Chipman wants banned if they're not delineated by any common parlance that we have? And he won't say. And just to give you an idea of his intransigence on the willingness to identify what an assault weapon is. Again, this is a person who, since his leaving the ATF years ago, has focused his professional life on being an advocate for banning these things. Well, what are the things? Is this an honest attempt at illuminating his position for elevation to this agency head before the American people?
I got 35 seconds left. Define it for me, would you please, sir? What's an assault weapon?
Yeah, Senator, the bill to ban assault weapons
is your
dozens of pages. There's no way I could define an assault weapon.
You don't have any. You're going to run this agency and you don't have a definition of assault weapon?
But I would be enforcing the definition that members of Congress
have. Yeah,
but you're
going to be issuing rules and regulations. Just give me your definition.
I'll give you one definition that ATF
Give me your definition.
Uses. One definition that ATF currently
Give me your definition.
I can give you one definition.
If you won't answer my question, how can I vote for you?
He simply refuses to do it. He won't tell us. Let's go back to the car example for just a second. Let's say that they wanted to ban sports cars. And people who were interested in driving and owning vehicles said, okay, fine. Well, what is a sports car? Does it have to have a certain amount of horsepower or torque or power to weight ratio? Maybe it's cars that don't have back seats where you can fit a full adult. It's rear wheel drive cars only. How would you define what a sports car is? Well, it's not terribly important for our purposes, except if you want to ban them and there's a fundamental right to own some of them, as expressed in the Second Amendment and backed up by current Supreme Court precedent. What makes a sports car? If you want to ban them, why don't you tell us what they are? And that's what's happening here with assault weapon ban. What it is just those of us who kind of have been down this rodeo before with the last assault weapons ban know that what happens is it's basically a cosmetic objection. Guns that look evil or nefarious, that look like a gangster might use, and that scare people, generally black plastic with aggressive-looking accessories, become lumped into the assault weapons category. Meanwhile, when there's a detailed engraving or filigree on the metal and beautiful wood stocks, well, that somehow is not an assault weapon, even though it would be like saying that the color that you paint a car. So it would be like if they banned flashy colored cars and you think, well, which of the colors am I permitted to own or which will I be able to have in the future? These are the kinds of things that go through our mind for possessing this legal product, which, by the way, none of those things affect the operation of the product or its lethality. And of course, for those of us that own them legally, they're just sitting in a closet or safe somewhere. And we wonder, are we to be branded felons if we don't turn in our property in the face of new regulations? Well, that's what's going on. And it's being buoyed by other elements of the sort of media that run this narrative. We saw this week a big push by this study by USA Today, and I saw it on PBS, where they had one of the authors of the study talking about lax enforcement by the ATF against gun dealers. And how the narrative goes is that there's a big problem at the ATF because they don't police the gun dealers. You might think to yourself, well, gee, that seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, if a gun dealer is doing bad stuff, why wouldn't the ATF go ahead and shut them down or enforce their regulations? Let's take a listen.
Nick Penzenstadler of USA Today is one of the lead investigative reporters and joins me now. Nick, thank you so much for your time. I read the report. It's comprehensive. And every time there's another mass shooting in this country, we ask these questions. Where can the cycle be broken? Your investigation focuses on that point of sale of the gun. What did you find that the ATF is falling short on there? And what's an example you found?
Right. We found a two-part problem here. We found gun sellers not following the rules and not living up to their promise to do the paperwork correctly and to ask for identification and record all the information about gun buyers correctly. And then we also found the ATF, who came to inspect those gun shops, not following up on their inspections and revoking licenses or doing any meaningful punishment to correct this action.
You notice how it's all paperwork violations that they're talking about? They didn't accurately record this, that, or the other thing. There's no information or discussion that this somehow is a disadvantage to the American people from their public safety profile or perspective, just that they didn't mark down every jot and tittle. And here's some of the things that those of us who have a long history of looking at how the ATF does their job, we know that what they can do is what they'll do is they'll go in or what they have done in the past, I should say. And this is some years ago when the Clinton administration ATF was being scrutinized by gun owners. And what they would do is they'd have these paperwork violations where you'd go in and when you buy a gun, you have to fill out, depending on where you live, a number of paperwork items. There's a federal form, though, and it includes things like where you live, and you have to put the city, the state, and the county, for instance. I think that was still on the form the last time I bought a gun, if I ever did, at retail. And if you don't put the county, though, or you put it in the wrong order, that is a violation of what is required to be on the form. And so, do you think a firearms dealer should be disciplined for that kind of violation, for saying, or last name first instead of first name last, those kinds of violations? Because the form clearly stipulates how these things need to be laid out. It's not the easiest thing to get through if you're trying to complete a sale purchase when you've got, you know, maybe a kid waiting for you or you're hungry or whatever at the register and you want to just get your gun and go home. You're already a law-abiding citizen. So if you don't put your date of birth with, for instance, the full year, you just put for maybe 73 instead of writing maybe 1973. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about with this accurate recording. Where is that? Where does that have to do with anything with the safety of Americans? Nick Penzenstadler of USA Today goes back into it to discuss why, pray tell, are these ATF, these federal regulations being violated without sanction? What's going on here? It's pandemonium.
You specifically found that field investigators are coming up with recommendations and warnings. In some cases, they're recommending that a license to sell a gun be revoked, and higher-ups are overruling that. I guess the question is, why is that happening?
Well, there's tremendous pressure to not shut down a gun shop, especially for these paperwork errors. But we're really focused on these willful violations when a gun shop is given a second chance and a third chance, and they still can't seem to get it right. And many times a field investigator, like you said, will recommend them for revocation, but then a higher up will give them some more leniency and another chance to reform. And that's really based on this effort to get compliance versus shutting down a business.
Are there valid reasons for why they would overrule a recommendation to revoke a license? Is it because they want to keep businesses open, or is there something more nefarious you found?
We certainly saw many reasons. I mean, we saw reasons ranging from this shop just opened, we need to give them a chance to get their feet under them, to this shop has been open for decades, let's give them a break because this is only a few mistakes in hundreds and thousands of sales. So we also saw that number based on volume. If a shop sold a ton of guns and they had a small number of errors, obviously the ATF would give them a little more leniency. But really the concern is that the ATF is unwilling or unable to shut down shops because of the political pressure and the legal resources it takes to string those out.
So it's political pressure not to shut down the shops. What shops do you think are able to generate political pressure not to shut them down in the face of an ATF investigation? Is it one where the people who patronize the shop are responsible for selling guns that are used on the streets of Chicago to murder people or any other inner city? That's outrageous to suggest that there's political motivation, or rather political pressure or will, to suppress the enforcement of our nation's gun laws at gun shops. Where political pressure exists is to say, yeah, he didn't accurately record the county of the person's birth or these other paperwork violations. You can't shut a gun store down for that. Look at the examples that the person gives. Mr. Penzenstadler, right? It's a new gun shop that doesn't have their footing under them. So there's no suggestion that they helped somebody get a gun against the law or acted illegally to introduce guns into an illegal stream of commerce or black market or for nefarious purposes. It's a new gun shop that doesn't quite know what they're doing. They don't have all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, so they give them a little bit of a pass. Or if it's the over thousands and thousands and thousands of transactions, they make a small mistake. Well, what is he demanding perfection from the firearms industry with respect to these record keeping requirements? It seems like it's a lot of much ado about nothing. There are zero cases where they can come back for their thousands. I think they said they investigated 2,000 gun transactions where they found some of these errors, but none of them were connected to a homicide. These aren't cases where somebody has killed somebody or done something else with the gun that you would think, oh my Lord. No, this is just paperwork violations. You'll notice too that there's no mention of how the ATF got to this state where they're doing things that clearly the legacy media and left do not like. The study in question concerns firearms transactions that occurred between 2015 and 2017. Now, those are the years Barack Hussein Obama was in office until a little bit of 2017. But I'm going to go ahead on a limb here and suggest that Donald Trump didn't have a massive influx of ATF rule changes in his first couple months in office. So these are Obama people. And by the way, they're not Obama people in the first year or 2 years or three or four or five of the Obama Biden administration, these two rabid anti-gunners. What we're left with is what the gun-owning community suspects, which is that these people are eager to deny us of our rights and our heritage with respect to being a gun-owning people and the power that allows the people to have, the devolution of power from central authority to the people from being armed, because they don't actually use the power that they have to accomplish their stated goals, right? So you get a situation where never been a more rabidly anti-gun administration than the Obama-Biden administration, and yet they are not even making sure that the ATF goes to the wall with this kind of maximum scrutiny they can apply. Now, I don't want to give the wrong impression that I think that I wish they would. I think that Mr. Penzenstadler's description of how the ATF operates, if it's accurate, is exactly how you want an organization to operate.
And Nick, what is the ATF's explanation for this leniency?
The word from the ATF is that, you know, they really only go after the willful violators. They're only going to focus on the most serious issues, and they only have the resources to go after so many.
They witness a violation of the rules. It's their duty to flag violations of the rules. They flag the violation of the rules. They pass it up the chain of command. And the supervisory level person says, well, yes, it is a violation of the rule. But also, this is a gun shop that doesn't have any history with supporting criminals. And it's a paperwork violation. And so we're not going to ding them. And dinging them could be banning them. Basically, if you remove their ability to legally sell a firearm with their federal permit, or any kind of suspension or other penalty for no deficiency on their part that was a willful act in violation of the law or advanced crimes. They must just not have had the right people in place. Personnel is, of course, policy. And we're going to see David Chipman likely be the next director of the ATF, and we'll see what he does with it, but it doesn't look good. The journalists themselves are convinced that the activist is going to use his position, if he gets it, as head of the ATF to advance on this front.
President Biden's current pick for heading up the ATF is known to be a staunch proponent of gun control. Do you see him having the authority to change this culture at the ATF if he is confirmed?
Yes. David Chipman was on the Hill yesterday talking about this exact issue.
Well, we'll see what happens with Mr. Chipman's. We will keep you posted with Mr. Chipman's nomination and leadership of the agency. We do have a Supreme Court case scheduled to be heard in the fall, which discusses whether Americans can keep and bear arms as a right guaranteed by the Second Amendment outside the home. And there will be other Supreme Court issues, no doubt, if Mr. Chipman has his way and becomes the agency head and then moves aggressively against assault weapons, quote unquote, air quotes, and other gun rights. And we'll have to see what the Supreme Court, which has so far been extraordinarily timid on the gun rights front, will do. The efforts to pack the United States Supreme Court by progressive Democrats continues apace. A helpful Uprising viewer sent in a link to a presentation by Demand Justice, which is the organization the Democrats set up to oppose Republican judicial nominees and to pack the court. It's run by, the presentation we see has Howard Dean and a woman who was Hillary Clinton's press secretary and basically a Clinton partisan. And Howard Dean revealed what the real enemy is.
Does money equal speech, and are corporations people too?
Right, and clearly the Constitution says no. This is made up law. This is what the Republicans have done. They have made up the law. There's no law that says corporations are people. And what they did was open the gates for huge amounts of money, dark money, to influence the political process. This is not done in the interest of ordinary Americans. This is done in the service of the Federalist Society. These same corporations that are using this enormous loophole created by Citizens United are also benefiting by the huge tax cuts at the expense of ordinary working Americans. Ordinary working Americans didn't get much of a tax cut from Trump's tax cut. The people who got that tax cut were the billionaires. I'm going to sound like Bernie Sanders here for a minute. The billionaires who donated to the Federalist Society so they could get their taxes cut. So the court has simply become another corrupt political player in this process that we have. And I think that is, I really think Citizens United has done more damage to the United States of America than Al-Qaeda has.
I thought that was a real revelation. It's about the Federalist Society and Citizens United. That's what they can't abide and need to get rid of. And Citizens United is what allows me to speak to you now. The Citizens United decision was famously the one that said that corporate speech or speech through a corporate form had First Amendment protection. And what happened was this organization decided to produce a video that was deleterious to Hillary Clinton's chances of winning the presidency and wanted to send it out to inform people about it. And it was violative of federal law that prohibited disparaging remarks made about a candidate some days before the election, something or other, that restricted the speech. Meanwhile, there was no restriction for traditional newspapers and television networks, which, of course, were totally biased in favor of the left-wing candidate, as they often are. It's just sort of how it works. But if they're allowed to operate, but Liberty Nation isn't, or some group of people who gather together to put out information about a candidate near an election, which, by the way, like, do you think the First Amendment would be more protective of speech about a candidate for election near the election, or less protective about that kind of speech in favor of what? A soap commercial made in an off year? Well, no, of course it's all about that political speech, the hottest speech there is, the most controversial. That's where that protection needs to be. And that's where it is. Fortunately for us, including Justice Ginsburg, who voted with the majority in Citizens United to say that there is free speech protection for people who use their speech in under the corporate form, just like they could individually, but they have a harder time paying for the microphone and the distribution if they act individually rather than collectively under the corporate form, and it allows others to promote that speech. So sad to see a governor of a state and the head of the Democrat or former head of the Democrat Party have that opinion of free speech, but it's illustrative. They have to get it out because they can't handle when there is effective opposition speech. It's good to be the king, I'm sure, but that's not how we are set up. Can you imagine this sworn enemy of America that murdered over 3,000 Americans is worse than a rule that says that all the individual right that we have to speak freely the truth, not lies, but speak freely, that when we use it collectively, it's worse than those mass murderers. That's Howard Dean. Wow. Okay. Another clip from that presentation, which I thought was illustrative, is the power grab notion.
But it feels like there's a, tell me if you agree with this, there's a bit of a sense of urgency because we need to have, that's what I'm saying, because we need these democracy reforms. We need to restore the balance, because if you look at what you're talking about, this pattern of decisions that essentially has gotten to the point where ordinary Americans, we don't have the same voice in the highest court in the land that we may have once had, and that there is this solution on the table. I'm going to keep bringing us back to that because I think it's important for people to understand. We don't need a constitutional amendment. That's we right. can do this by passing legislation. And so that's part of this urgency, along with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, along with H.R. 1. There are a number of things that are before Congress right now.
The problem today is the American.
And that's Karen Finney, I apologize for her voice. It's all about power. Why not say, if you really have a studious, a legitimate objection to the way our Supreme Court is operating and the number of justices for various reasons, why not say, okay, fine, we'll add Supreme Court justices in the next presidential term. You can pass a law that says it's all just a federal law, right? That's what Ms. Finney tells us. Well, let's authorize the addition of Supreme Court justices. And I don't actually think this is a good idea, but if you were committed to adding the justices and you wanted to do it in a fair way, add them with the next cycle so that people can then vote on whether or not the person is going to, the president we know will have at least an additional three choices or four choices on the federal, excuse me, it's 9, 10, 11, 10, 11, 12, 13. They want to add four, right? Sorry for the math. If you give people the choice, that's a more honest way to do it, it seems to me. But that's not what they're about. They got the power now. They want to do it and strike while the iron's hot in order to force these existential changes through while they have the juice. It seems to me it's hard to do that and then claim you're about democracy in a kind of more inclusive way rather than the way that we all fear, which is, of course, that it's two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner, and we're the sheep. No city is worse off for gun violence than Chicago, which is hostile, by the way, to lawful possession of gun ownership. Everybody in Chicago, you could be a 12-year-old kid on the street, you've got a firearm, but try to be a law-abiding person to get one, and it's hard. Well, Lori Lightfoot certainly has an uphill battle as mayor of Chicago and trying to contain the violence, but she's not resting on her laurels. She's doing the hard work of discriminating illegally against white people. Why, yes, that's right. Lori Lightfoot said that she would only allow persons of color to interview her. She's been sued now by Thomas Catanacci, a white reporter for the Daily Caller, who's sued in the Federal District Court of Northern Illinois. And he alleges a violation of his First and 14th Amendment rights. I think the 14th Amendment claim is going to be the better one, although I do think that because it was for a limited time, the refusal to interview, I don't think the claim will be successful. But I'm grateful to Mr. Catanacci for bringing it. Really, it's a Tucker Carlson. That's his outlet, the Daily Caller. It's a Tucker Carlson suit against Lori Lightfoot. But she is not going to go ahead and admit that there was anything wrong with discriminating against somebody on the basis of the color of their skin. No, she takes the diversity cape and wears it like a hero.
We can follow up on the decision to grant black and brown journalists the one-on-ones on your 2-year anniversary. For those of us who've covered you on the beat since the beginning of your campaign, are you implying that white reporters cannot do a fair job of covering you?
It has nothing to do about you, Craig, with due respect, or anybody else. What it has to do about is the facts. And the facts is that when I look out at across this podium, as I'm doing now, I don't see much in the way of diversity. The fact that the City Hall press corps is overwhelmingly white, has very little in the way of diversity, is an embarrassment. We are a city that is almost 3/4 people of color. I believe that the City Hall press corps needs to reflect the diversity of our city. And I saw some of the commentary, which frankly was insulting, to suggest that journalists of color won't ask the tough questions. Really? To suggest that somehow I'm saying certain journalists are racist? Really? No, the facts are the facts. And the fact is that this press corps does not reflect the diversity of the city, and it makes a difference in the kinds of coverage. Everybody, me, you, everybody, brings our life experiences to the way that we perceive events. All of us bring an implicit bias. And what I'm saying is, it's way past time It's way past time for the City Hall Press Corps and the people that do the hiring and make the decisions to get the memo.
Well, so much for the mere plus factor of diversity. The reason it's illegal in this country to discriminate against somebody in public accommodation or government function on the basis of certain immutable characteristics, including their race. That's been allowed to happen to favor disadvantaged races in certain instances as a plus factor. But it's never been allowed to ban or disallow white people from participating in anything. So you can have a plus factor in college admission, for instance, for a quote-unquote minority candidate, even though women, they're not minorities, but whatever. But you can't say, well, you can't have any men in law school because we want to up the quotient of women lawyers, for instance. You can just give plus factors, but that's not what Lightfoot is doing. And I just think the problem is that she doesn't see that it is a problem. To actually have the gall to tell people in the Chicago media market that they need to hire people based on the color of their skin, that's exactly what that statement does. It says if I'm a white person and I'm up for a job with Chicago media, the day after that goes out, do I have a fair shot against somebody who's of color that Lori Lightfoot would be willing to sit down against? It seems like I'm not, and it's totally on the basis of the color of skin, which, well, we know, unfortunately, in America, that's becoming all the more important to have that favored hue rather than a disfavored one. Speaking of which, Sean King is in the news. The recently defeated, as we detailed on this podcast, Carlos Vega, who lost the Philadelphia District Attorney's race to the progressive Soros candidate, Larry Krasner, has sued not Mr. Krasner, but Mr. Krasner's campaign and Sean King and his PACs and allies for violating the law, for using basically in order to pump funds illegally in violation of campaign laws into Larry Krasner's pocket and into the pockets of Mr. King's organization and the campaign. So the complaint itself wasn't accessible to me on the computer just yet. I did try to look at it. I think it's over 300 pages, so perhaps it's a small mercy that I wasn't able to access it so that I could report on it for you. But in any case, whether it's Talcum X, Martin Luther Cream, or W.E.B. Defraud, one thing we know for sure about Mr. King is he does conduct a massive fraud on Americans by proclaiming to be a black man when he isn't a white man. And when you're that fundamental about, you know, when you lie about the questions of your basic identity, is it fair to think that we might be a little loose with the campaign laws? Well, we'll see. I guess we don't want to get too far down that road until we actually see the evidence, but we will follow the case both in the pages of LibertyNation.com, today's sponsor, and also right here on The Uprising. That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, Liberty Nation Radio, The Rabbit Hole Podcast, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to LibertyNation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Who are we? We are Americans that believe in liberty. We are a project of the nonprofit, one generation away. We are patriots who apply the founding principles to the issues of today.
And they keep moving the goalposts on us.
We are educators and commentators who love America and the Constitution. Who are we? We are Liberty Nation.